exciting and new. Come aboard, we're expecting you.
Hey guys, welcome to the Hollywood Outsider. We did not change our theme song. It just goes along with our topic this week, so we'll get there in a second. We are a weekly movie and TV podcast with a new episode every Thursday. This week we're going to discuss upcoming releases, including 3 Days to Kill and Pompeii. We're going to have spoiler-free reviews of a bunch of movies. Several people have asked, where are the reviews? Well, there haven't been any movies out. That's where they've been. So this week we've got RoboCop, Monuments Men, the Lego Movie, because everything is awesome. Odd Thomas, and we're going to tell you about a cool little independent film called The Projectionist and how they're using Kickstarter to sell their movie a little differently than we're used to. Our From the Outside In topic this week, which is going to be a big part of the show, we're going to talk about love, baby. We're going to talk about it in our own way. We're going to talk about favorite couples, movies, and we're also going to find out, is it really unfair to still call them chick flicks? We're going to have the latest in movie and TV news, including our own trivia segments. My name is Aaron Peterson. With me today are my fellow hosts, Scotty Clark.
You throw me off, man. Not the whole, this is the Hollywood Outsider.
No, somebody probably turned off. I don't even know what the show is, man. I'm done. Justin McCumber.
What's going on there, Aaron?
I don't know, but you got really loud. I feel like you're in my face.
Justin's spinning the hits from the
70s and 80s. I'm in your face, in your pants, whichever, you know.
Whoa, and speaking of in my pants, Brian Williams.
Hey! As if on cue, popping out of the zipper. So this week, do I have like amnesty?
No.
Anything I say this week will not be held against me in future weeks?
Absolutely. Yeah, you could do whatever you want.
All right. So I can put on my sensitive hat this week and I won't be judged. I won't have it held against me.
You're not going to try to pretend like you're a manly man? That's what I was expecting.
We'll see.
We'll see. Everybody else is like, my favorite romantic comedy is this. Brian, yeah, I don't watch those. I'm sorry. I'm too busy with a chainsaw chopping down trees out back. Ain't got time.
I'm a lumberjack and I don't. Oh.
What? He's just making up songs. Who saw that Samuel L. Jackson going off on the news reporter because he called him Lawrence Fishburne? Anyone?
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Yeah.
Okay. Who thought it was A, funny, or who thought it was B, ridiculous? Which corner is everybody in?
A little bit of both.
And just to explain, if you haven't seen it, I mean, find it on YouTube. It's just Sam Jackson is not Lawrence Fishburne. It's a reporter kept referring to him as Lawrence Fishburne, and he went off saying, "We don't all look alike, man." It's pretty funny.
What's funny is the whole interview starts out with this guy interviewing Samuel L. Jackson, asking him if he gets surprised when the phone rings. Like, how is that not an insulting thing to say to somebody? Like, you're basically saying, "How are you? Are you surprised that you're still getting work?" That's more or less what he said. And then he said, "How'd you feel about that Super Bowl commercial you're in? You know, the Matrix commercial." And Samuel Jackson's like, "What Super Bowl commercial?
Idiot.
I'm not Lawrence Fishburne." And then he just went off on this tirade, and it was one of those that was almost, is that guy really that dumb and thought that he was, didn't know he was interviewing?
He's an entertainment reporter.
Exactly. That's like his job. How do you not know the difference between two prolific actors?
And Lawrence Fishburne has a huge head. Black, white, Asian, Mexican, whatever he is, his head is huge.
And Samuel Jackson has a very recognizable voice.
Hell yeah, he does, the mofo.
It's like Sputnik.
It is. Lawrence Fishburne is having almost his own weather system.
And it's funny watching the interviewer like look off screen, like, oh crap. Oh crap. You can just see him.
Yeah, I wonder if he still has a job.
Of all the actors you probably don't want to piss off. I've seen Pulp Fiction. Come on.
Nerds, Star Wars will start shooting mid-May through September. It's officially been announced that that's when they're shooting. Casting announcements are going to be coming soon. So please, for the love of God, stop speculating. Just wait. The Oscar contest. Go to the HollywoodOutsider.com. You'll find the link with all the details. You can win either a Blu-ray of your choice or a guest spot on the show. The details are all on the website. The subject line that you want is, "I'm an Oscar ho." You'll see the details that you have to have that subject line. It's, "I'm an Oscar ho." Email us contests@thehollywoodoutsider.com with all the details that are in that post, and we can get you in the contest. So good luck to everybody that enters. Let's go to movie news. Will Smith decided to pass on Independence Day 2 for unnamed reasons, most likely because Jaden couldn't get in it. What I want to know is this. Whether Independence Day gave him his career or not, because he had Bad Boys before that, is debatable. But it definitely helped it. So does this cause you to second-guess your appreciation for the guy when he refuses to go back to the movie that started his career?
Not really, because I mean he probably knows a lot more or has seen a lot more about what this film is going to be than any of us will. This makes me worry less about what it means for his career or what it does for him as an actor or what he should or shouldn't do. It makes me worry more about the project being quality than anything else. If he looks at that and says, I don't want anything to do with it, mm-hmm. that makes me think we're in for something that's not going to be even bad to be good. It's just going to be bad. He's obviously not afraid of sequels. He did Men in Black 3 times, and I actually found out today that they're rebooting that franchise with him.
Without him. He passed on it.
He did pass officially?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, he passed on it.
What I read then wasn't updated then, but this he's staying away from. Mm-hmm. Independence Day, a sequel to Independence Day, seems like that would be a cash gold. It made, what, $880 million or something like that?
Yeah, and that was almost 20, not quite, we found out last week, but almost 20 years old.
Right. So that just makes me not very hopeful for this movie.
Justin, what about you? Because you had sincere thoughts on this earlier.
Well, I mean, I had my initial reaction when this information came out. I can't help but wonder if this wasn't a case of, I'm too good for that sort of movie now. But, Scott's right. I'm sure he was shown a lot more about this movie than we know at this point. He has a lot more information to base his decision on. So hopefully this is a case of him, passing on a bad project and less I'm too good for that movie franchise now. But yeah, initially I really thought, oh, Mr. go-to in Hollywood, suddenly he can't, welcome aliens to Earth and shit.
Well, he did do After Earth, so we know his standards aren't that.
Well, but that gets all wrapped up in his son and that career and then the family at large and how they seem to, be trying to position themselves as some kind of Hollywood entertainment industry just within themselves. And I do worry that Will Smith has gone from this down to earth, kind of guy that he was in the beginning with the Fresh Prince and Bad Boys and Independence Day. And suddenly the press that he's garnered over the years maybe has gone to his head, and suddenly he thinks he's
kind of big-timing us a little bit.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. I hope that is not the case, but I've just got a bad feeling that it is.
But I also think you got to take into account Roland Emmerich, the director, hasn't done well the last decade. So, I mean, Will Smith has always been a very smart actor. I mean, he seems to pick material, with the exception of After Earth being his one stumbling block. He seems to have a pretty good grasp of material. My opinion is, if he's saying he doesn't want to do it, it has more to do with the material or the direction than it does the actual I'm a big shot. I don't know. He's just never seemed like that kind of guy. He might have finally bought into it. I don't know, but I have a hard time believing that. But I'm also a big Willie fan.
All right. Big Willie style, brother.
Yep, exactly. I'm glad Brian didn't jump on that. All right. So
no, I've never jumped on Big Willie. Big Willie.
That's four.
Yeah, that's four. All right. Well, not to get all political, but some news anchors are trying to say that the Lego movie is indoctrinating, quote unquote, our kids into thinking everything but big business is awesome. Is this just plain going too far, or is there a little bit of truth to it?
All you have to do is look at who said it on what network. It's Fox Business. So you can, at least I can, almost immediately ignore anything and everything that's said. It is a well-known fact at this point that Fox, as a news organization, has a particular bias.
Okay, we got that, hippie. What about the point?
I don't think it's an accurate point. These sorts of movies where business or banking or whatever has been a bad guy in movies for decades. It's been the bad guy in books before that. This isn't anything new. Just look at A Wonderful Life. Is that movie anti-banking? Should we no longer let people watch that on Christmas because it sends out a bad message to children's? No, it doesn't. Neither does this, nor do any of the other movies. Sure, they want to say that it's following in the footsteps of the Muppets and the Lorax with indoctrinating children into thinking that big business is bad. I don't think it's true. I think every story needs a bad guy. And in these particular movies, sure, it was businessmen who were bad guys. In other movies, it's politicians. In others, it's bad cops. They're making mountains out of molehills. But again, it's Fox business. What do you expect?
Well, I mean, there's not much in the business world to really harp on. So you got to fill time somehow. Just
right.
You know, and that's just what they're doing is they're just kind of scratching at something that's really not even a sore. It's just
a 24-hour news organization that has to fill time.
Yep.
Why not get on the Lego movie and spend 10, 15 minutes on that? Sure, go.
And it's success.
Yep.
There's stories like this that just make me roll my eyes. It just seems that they're grasping at straws for something to – they're just trying to find something wrong with something.
They're digging at the Hollywood industry, which they have always seen as, you know, liberal Hollywood has an agenda against big business, completely ignoring the fact that liberal Hollywood is a big business.
Right. And not everyone has politics in mind when they make art.
Right.
I mean, some people really don't care. Stop messing with good things. You know, there's a lot worse things going on in entertainment that could affect an otherwise impressionable young person than politics.
Yeah, I would think so.
I mean, Fox is going to get Fox News is going to get on lots of violence and over sexualization in movies, that kind of thing. This just seems like you're just looking to find something bad in something that is so good.
I think they're riding the coattails of the Lego movie's success because it was so huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the biggest box office and, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I think they're totally missing, or at least they're ignoring completely, is that if you've seen the movie, it's really about not so much business, but commerce versus imagination. Mm-hmm. And how, like, kids today don't use their imagination, and how everything is constructed for them and they don't really have to put any thought into it. And it's really about, but kids have this imagination that they capture and da-da-da-da and get away from everything just being bought and sold to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that's so much against big business. It's about our culture and how we are anymore.
Right.
Is really what I got out of it. Fun haters.
It's just so frustrating.
Well, they hate fun. They do. Well, how about this? Vampire Academy? That's business that's going in the toilet. It flopped huge. And we'll get to how bad a little later. But in the youth adult genre, after Beautiful Creatures, The Host, Mortal Instruments last year, do you guys think that the young adult adaptations, you know, before we had Twilight and Hunger Games are about the only ones that have been successful. The rest of them are just flopping left and right. Should it come to an end, or is it just that the studios are not putting the right talent behind these movies?
I kind of think you're a little bit on the mark there. I think it's really got to do with the subject matter.
Yep.
The actual selections of the actual books. I mean, right now it's just a, you know, it's kind of like a cash grab. Just what can we turn into something real quick? What can we, you know, this was a hit. What's something similar that we can kind of, you know, capitalize on this. I mean, you look at these, really the big three of these, you know, I would throw Harry Potter in there, but Harry Potter, Hunger Games, and Twilight, all of these were based on books that had fan bases that were larger than just young adults. I mean, you saw adults swapping books and stuff like that, reading them all over the place, you know. Teens and young adults are, I think they're generally less likely to kind of take a chance on a movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're more, you know, if their friends are, and when I say negative reviews, I don't necessarily mean they're watching, you know, listening to us per se, or maybe listening, you know, watching something on TV, but I think their friends like, yeah, I don't know if I really want to see that. And so they're, because their friends don't want to necessarily see it, they may not want to see it, where adults are more likely to take a chance on it. Really, the big part of this is timing. Is Harry Potter, the first Harry Potter movie came out between books 4 and 5. That progressively got darker, which kind of drew in more adults. Twilight came out a few months after the last book was done. So you had all that hype from that. I mean, Hunger Games was really about the only one that was, the series was finished, but it was such kind of like the first one of its genre that it kind of spun the others off. So it's kind of got, you know, hey, I was here first, so that works. So
first in terms of what? Because Twilight and Harry Potter were here long before.
First, in terms of like the heroic female and like a dystopian type.
Oh,
future.
I gotcha. Okay.
Kind of started that genre.
But something I think that you were leading to, but you didn't mention it. You know, you mentioned that these books were not only huge hits with their target audience of young adults and children, in the case of Harry Potter, but they were also massive hits with adults. I think what's happening is that these other things that they're picking, like Beautiful Creatures or The Mortal Instruments, Vampire Academy, I don't think that they have the same broad appeal. And I think that it's because the subject matter and the way that it's written is as intelligent and broad in its ability to hit a lot of targets. I think that's why Harry Potter was such a film success and why The Hunger Games, as well as its cast, those franchises have stories that young adults can enjoy, but they also are smart enough and deft enough that adults enjoy them too. I don't know any adults who've read Mortal Instruments or Vampire Academy or Beautiful Creatures. Those aren't those water cooler type book series that, you know, you hear people talking about. Those successful film franchises, though, are. And I think it's that lack of broad appeal and consumption that ultimately dooms them at the theater. Because if I'm not going to read the book because it looks too childish, I'm certainly not going to go to the theater and see a movie that's just going to be the same thing.
I think they struck gold with Twilight because, well, Twilight, all of them, really. And as much as I'm not a fan of Twilight, but they took a story that had something unique going on. Same with Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. Same with Hunger Games. There's something, a fresh idea that's intriguing just by reading the back cover of the book or reading the synopsis. I have seen trailers for Vampire Academy and Beautiful Creatures and The Host and Mortal Instruments, and nothing about any of those went, oh, that's kind of clever. Or it just seemed like...
They all seem rehashes of the three series.
Right.
Vampire Academy. Something you see on the CW.
Yes. That's a very good way to put it. I think Brian kind of hit it on the head with it. It has to do with the subject matter. They're picking the wrong YA books, and I don't know which ones there are. Mm-hmm. I don't read them as much as
I'm very happy that you don't know, actually.
I heard A Minor Magic's pretty good.
Oh, shut up.
Jesus. So I just hope that they start picking, if it's going to be a viable thing, they need to pick more interesting stories that are grabbing. I mean, dystopian society, woman kind of heads up and leads an uprising kind of thing, interesting. A wizard school, interesting. Vampires that sparkle in sunlight, okay.
With werewolves.
Now yeah. I'm interested. Shirtless werewolves.
Shirtless werewolves with 4,000 abs.
Best kind.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of love. Well, let's move on to, we've lost a couple, actually classic actors this week. Shirley Temple passed away. She's a cinematic legend. And Sid Caesar just passed away as well. So if you guys don't know who those two are, you should look them up because they're kind of pioneers in their fields. And Shirley Temple was just one of the first box office young stars. She was a kid.
First child actors.
Yeah. Huge. She was Shia LaBeouf before it was cool. You know what I mean?
I bet she didn't do too much heroin.
Probably not.
Maybe a little coke bump every now and again, but who doesn't?
And she probably never went to a premiere with a bag in her head either.
No. Genius, Shia. Genius.
Welcome to Brian's Trailer Park. Alrighty, well, in what is sure to kill sales for electric hybrid cars, The Purge 2 Anarchy comes out on June 20th. And we see a young couple stranded on the streets after their eco-friendly car runs out of patchouli. Now, they're on so pretty much they're left on their own to survive for the next 12 hours as the annual purge commences. I still haven't personally seen The Purge. I'm anxious to watch it, but I know a couple of you guys have. What, Aaron, I know you've seen it, but mm-hmm. What'd you think about this follow-up?
Well, like I said earlier, when I talked about the movie itself, The Purge was really good for the first half of it. And then the second half of it, it became like generic thriller. You know, mm-hmm. everything you could see coming a mile away. I still love the concept of it. I think it's great. I think I would love to have this. You got 12 hours and you can do anything you want. I mean, I wouldn't do anything. I would sit there and be civilly minded. The trailer, they're taking the concept, they're taking a different approach to what they did the last time. It's not just people stuck in a house. Now they're on the streets and trying to get through. Frank Grillo's in this, who I think is great. So I'm really excited to see it. I'm hoping that they improve on the concept and don't do so much of cheap and easy road like they did last time.
I don't know. I think this movie is nothing but anti-big green business.
It's true.
Did you see the original, Justin?
Do what?
Did you see the original?
I did. I watched it on video on demand, and it was okay. I mean, it had a unique premise. I'm agreeing with Aaron. It was interesting to start, but then it just got into predictable territory. To me, this just looks like a slasher film, but where everybody's a slasher.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't look interesting in the least little bit.
Really? Oh, see, I feel just the opposite. I'm with Brian in that I didn't see the original, and it sounds like how that movie turned out is kind of what I expected from the first one, and that a really awesome concept that just didn't – the implementation wasn't as good as I would have liked. But this trailer makes me want to go back and watch the first one in prep for this one, because I think – the transition to the second one is awesome. Breaking down right before that happens, awesome. I
that's convenient, because I wouldn't leave my damn house at least 5 hours before this thing was going to start.
I got to go get some groceries.
Yeah.
No way.
I need cigarettes, baby. I'll be right back. But the purge is going to start. I'll be right back. That never goes bad.
That's pretty much it for this week. We just got the one this week, because we got a whole lot more to talk about later on. But you can check out this trailer, and of course a lot more at TheHollywoodOutsider.com. You can reach us a number of ways. You can call us or text us at 818-81-IMAHOE. That's 818-814-6246. And our email is feedback@TheHollywoodOutsider.com. You can get us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. Tweet us at H_Outsider. And get your IMAHOE t-shirts at TheHollywoodOutsider.com. Aaron?
All right, now let's go to the big screen, where we have seen several movies, and we haven't reviewed this many movies in a while. Justin, tell us about RoboCop.
Yeah, RoboCop, a remake of the Paul Verhoeven film from the 80s. This shares some of the same story DNA as a previous film. It changes quite a few other things, though, and I think most of our conversation is going to focus on the differences between the two films. But for those who've never seen either of these films, the synopsis is it's pretty simple. In 2020, Detroit, Alex Murphy, played by, in this film, Joel Kinnaman, is a loving husband, father, and a good cop, but he's critically injured in the line of duty. After that, a multinational conglomerate, Omnicorp, sees their chance for a part man, part robot police officer. This was directed by Jose Padilla. It stars, as I said, Joel Kinnaman. It also has Gary Oldman and Michael Keaton, Abby Cornish, Jackie Earle Haley, who for some reason, every time I look at him, I want to call him Joel Osment. I don't know why I want to do that, but three name people need to just stop it.
Okay, then.
Just stop it.
That's an odd point to bring up, but well, you go ahead.
Unless you're a serial killer.
Oh, yeah.
You or don't go with three names.
But Aaron, you saw this film. I saw it today. You've seen the original, mm-hmm. and I don't think that it is unfair to critique a remake, not just as its own film, but also in its differences to the original. I did see these stories were quite different. Mm-hmm. Between the two films, which story did you like better, or maybe another way of looking at it, which one do you think hit its target better?
Honestly, I think this one. I get the original one was going for satire and violence. Got it. I prefer this take on it because it was going more for how much man would actually be in the machine. You know, if you put a man in a machine, how much of the man actually remains? I don't think you got that from the original. The original was more about, oh, look at how violent movies of this time are, which it got, but that really wasn't as interesting to me. So I'm probably in the minority for that. Most people prefer the violence angle. I really liked this take on it. I thought it was really interesting. It was really creative. And as far as I'm concerned, if you're going to remake a movie, this is the way you should do it. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie, but this is the way you do it. Because you make the movie, the basic plot is the same. But so many aspects of it are completely different. Mm-hmm. Completely different.
Yeah, I mean, the first film, you know, Paul Verhoeven, being a European writer-director, I think he looked at American cinema as just this place of pure violence. And so he wanted to make a film that really showed that, I mean, amped it up to the nth degree. And that's the film that he wanted to make. But this film is being, you know, it's done at a different time. It's an age where we all walk around with devices in our hands. We all have the internet at home that keeps us all connected 24 hours a day. We live in a much more technology-driven time, and so it makes sense that this story wouldn't be about the violence, but it would be more about, you know, where does man and machine end when you put them together, and is it right to put them together? Mm-hmm. And I really felt like this film hit that concept, hit it right on the head. Mm-hmm. I mean, early on in the film, there's a brief scene where a man has had his hand or maybe his whole arm replaced with a robotic arm, and he's attempting to play an instrument. And how does someone who has this mechanical arm play with the same deftness, deftness, is it possible? And it's a really, it's a kind of a touching scene, because he's frustrated by what his hand can and can't do. But through talking with Gary Oldman's character, it's like, you know, music and those sorts of things, they come from the heart. They don't come from the hand. The hand's just an instrument. And so you kind of have to relearn a little bit of how you play. But it was a nice interaction, a moment of seeing the interaction between man and machine. But RoboCop takes that to a much higher degree, because suddenly you've got almost an entire body being replaced. Mm-hmm. And I did like a particular scene where you see just how much of him has been replaced with a machine and his reaction to that. I really thought it was incredibly well done, and I was really pleased with how this film handled its story and all the changes that it made from the original. But, you know, in a film like this, so much of what has to reach us as an audience is going to come through the performance, and our lead character has a helmet over his head for quite a bit of it.
Yeah, he does.
So Joel Kinnaman had a pretty hard job ahead of him. What do you think about his performance as well as everybody around him?
I'll tell you, I didn't like him as a human as much. I actually preferred him when he got to be a robot. It seemed like he saved most of his performance for when he became RoboCop. Mm-hmm. And the facial expressions, because in this version, you know, in the original version, his family thought he was dead. And he had no idea who he was. In this version, he still very much knows who he is for most of the movie. And his family is aware that he is RoboCop from the get-go. So he has to deal with that. There's a lot of emoting because of that. And I think he handles it well. It never felt cheap. It never felt too much. I really liked his take on it. And when he was fully enveloped in that, I was really moved. But who I really loved? Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton as the whatever he is. I don't want to say anything too much, because some people think he's a good guy. Some people think he's a bad guy. Some people think, you know, it depends on how you view it. I just loved his performance. He even had a few moments where I thought he was Beetlejuice.
I never quite got Beetlejuice out of him. But aside from Joel Kinnaman, and I'd heard an interview with him, and he said that one of his requests, and really not even a request, it's almost more of a demand, was that he be able to have that face mask retractable. Mm-hmm. So that he didn't have to go through the entire film just a clear shield and a mouth. He really wanted his humanity to show through, and in order to do that, they just put this little retractable face piece on. And I think that was a good call on his part, because it did remind you constantly that this isn't just a machine. This is a guy. And, you know, in the original RoboCop, whenever the helmet came off, he looked like a monster. Mm. I mean, it really looked Frankenstein freaky with the way his head was in this block of chrome.
And the skin was stretching back.
Yeah, stretched back. It was really freaky looking. But in this film, that doesn't happen. And so I think that was a good call. But for me, my favorite actor in this one was Gary Oldman.
Oh, he was good too. Yeah, he was good.
I thought his humanity, his desire to help people and do the right thing really kind of almost stole the show. He was almost a star for me, but I think everybody involved did a good job.
And I do want to add, Samuel L. Jackson, he basically plays a reporter who's obviously very biased. He's playing.
He's very foxy and
yeah. He's playing. Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at it, but it's definitely very media is biased, and we've already got our opinion, so we're trying to sway your opinion. Mm-hmm. Loved how they presented that, because that's how I view all news currently. Whatever their agenda is, they push that agenda and not, you know, the actual news, and that's exactly what he does. And I think that was done very well. That was a good satire.
Yeah, he did a really good job, and I especially. I won't say what happens at the end, but his final moments are fucking classic.
Yeah, they are.
And one last little bit. Michael K. Williams, who plays Joel Kinnaman's partner in the movie, I liked him quite a bit. But every time I see him in my brain, I say, oh, shit, here comes Omar from The Wire.
Yeah, he was in The Wire.
I will never be able to separate him from his character of Omar from the Wire. But you know, a film like this with all of these robots and bullets going off and drones flying through the sky and these HUDs and virtual sets, it's a pretty CGI heavy film. Surprisingly enough, the suit that he wears is for the most part is practical. Mm-hmm. And again, in the interview, he talked quite a bit about what it was like to wear that. But what did you think about the production of this film? Did you like the direction? Did you like the outfit? And overall, what did you think of the look of it?
I loved it. I liked the updating. I think that a lot of people saw the original trailer when it came out or the original screenshots, and they thought, well, that looks cheesy. And I was probably one of them. I thought the suit looked cheesy. The trailer looked good. But seeing it in action, it totally works. You know, they actually have the original RoboCop suit in the beginning. That's kind of cool. And, you know, and they have just enough nods to the original without it getting cheesy, which is really what I was worried about. You know, the lines, you know, you can't buy that for a dollar and stuff like that. It's got little takes on those, and they don't just jam it down your throat or do it poorly. I was a big fan of the special effects, the first-person shooting aspect of it. Scott, you'll love that when you see it in IMAX.
I was like, I want a video game that looks like that.
Yes, it looks just like a video game, and it's one you want to play, like, right now. So I very impressed by the director, because I've never heard of him, and he did a great job, sincerely. I was extremely surprised by this movie.
Hmm. What did you think of the Ed 209s?
I love that they're in there right off the bat. You know, it's nothing you're building up to. You see those suckers right off the bat.
Is that those machines, the two-legged machines?
Yeah, those two. Yeah.
Yeah, the big mech-looking things.
Yeah. The AT-ATs, the lower
butt. And it didn't cry like a baby when it was turned over.
No, it didn't. It didn't. But they had some really clever takes on how they would actually, how people could actually take one of those out. And I'm not going to spoil it because it's actually cool when you see it, and it's at the very beginning. But I like that. That was pretty cool. When you finally see it, you'll know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, overall, this film is beautiful. I mean, it is full of CGI, but it is almost seamless. It's hard to tell what's real and what's not. I think the outfit for RoboCop is stunning looking, especially the black one that they get him into for most of the film. He looks like a Lamborghini. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at the first RoboCop, and at the time, it looked really cool. But now you look at it, and it's almost like a Winnebago. I mean, it is so big and clunky and round, and there's just it's a VW bus. Whereas this guy's outfit, it's almost like right out of a Japanese comic book. It is so detailed and artfully done. I really, if they do a sequel for this, if this one does the business and they get to do another one, I'd really be curious to see how they're going to change it and update it. There are definitely some things that they could have done in this film with him that they didn't. I'm hoping that maybe they'll do them once they don't have to bother with all the origin story for him. But all in all, it's a beautiful film. I thought the action and the direction were spot on. I was very, very impressed with how this movie ended up. I was really afraid going in that it was going to suck. It, in my opinion, did not suck in the least little bit. But $1 out of $10, Aaron, what would you give this?
Pleasantly surprised, really surprised. If $10 is the full price permission, I give it $8.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. It's a good $8. It could have been a little more action-packed. Mm-hmm. There could have been a few changes here and there. But all in all, as an origin film for a new RoboCop, I think it works like gangbusters. And I love the change in tone from the original movie. And if you're one of those people that is so locked into the past and the nostalgia and cannot get your head around the idea that someone would take a movie that perhaps you love and redo it, then just don't go see this. I don't want a lot of pissed off hipsters walking out of theater saying, well, it's not my RoboCop, and then just crapping on it because you can't get over yourself. It's a good film. Don't compare it to what you remember the old one being, because trust me, I rewatched it recently. It ain't as good as you remember it being.
It doesn't hold up. Scott, you saw something that is awesome, I think.
Everything I think. Is
you
awesome.
You saw the Lego movie.
I did see the Lego movie.
Tell us about Lego.
Well, the Lego movie is a 3D animated movie that takes place in a world made completely out of the popular building blocks that we all play with when we were kids. The main character is Emmett. He's an ordinary Lego man with an optimistic spirit who wants nothing more than to make friends with everybody he knows.
It's like you in right? Lego form.
Sadly, no one really pays him much mind, just like me, as he goes
through. That was the saddest pause ever. Just like me.
And he basically goes through his days as a construction worker until the day when he's mistaken to be what they call a master builder in the Lego world. Master builder is someone who's destined to save the universe in some form. And in this form, he is to save them from the evil Lord Business. Yes, that's his name. Mm-hmm. And this guy is hell-bent on gluing the entire Lego world together. Literally, like glue. Taking the pieces and gluing it all together so they can't move. Now, the story itself is not totally original. It's kind of a cookie cutter of pretty much every someone's got to save the world kind of movie. But the execution here is really unique. It's just so clever. I throw that word around a lot, but it's just so clever what they do. The story is very fast paced. There's quite literally never a dull moment. Mm-mm. In this movie.
No.
In fact, it almost moves a little too quickly. And that's coming from someone who has entertainment ADD. Seriously.
Yeah, you told me that, and I'm like, what are you talking about, Scott? You can't focus for longer than 8 seconds.
This movie is exhausting. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. There's no break for the entire I don't remember how long it was exactly.
It's about an hour and a half.
An hour and a half. And you know how most of these animated movies, if you have a spectrum of it being a total kids movie or being a movie that's for kids and adults, this one definitely mm-hmm. leans a little bit more towards the kid side, I think. I don't want you to think of that as a negative, though, because it hits on more cylinders, but there are some very silly stuff that's more kid-friendly. That's really the only negative thing I can say about the story, though, because the third act really makes this movie. You don't really even realize how clever this is until they drop this bomb on you that just mm-hmm. kind of flips the movie on its head, and it's just really, really cool. As far as acting, we talk about these kind of animated movies. You're just looking at voices of famous people, more or less. And there is no short supply of voice actors in this one. Chris Pratt, who I was not familiar with before this.
Oh, he's on Parks and Rec.
Parks and Rec, yeah. He plays the role of Emmett superbly. He gives the character a kind of a clueless, optimistic approach. He's a very innocent kind of character.
Seriously, dude, I thought it was you the whole time.
He's kind of Scotty-ish. Mm-hmm.
Makes him very likable. Will Arnett as Batman was brilliant.
He's so good.
He really is. His tone is perfect. Will Ferrell, he's not new to playing the voice of a villain. You know, he had like Megamind and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how differently he plays this villain than a typical cartoon character that even plays like in his real life movies. He has such a range with that. Liam Neeson, I never realized he had such versatility with his voice as he did with this character, who is really one of the funniest characters in this movie. And he's not like trying to be. Like, the character himself is not trying to be.
No, when you hear Liam Neeson be goofy, that cracks you up.
It really does. So many cameos. Charlie Day, Anthony Daniels. Yes, that Anthony Daniels, mm-hmm. Justin. Dave Franco, Morgan Freeman, Jonah Hill, Nick Offerman, Kobe Smulders, Channing Tatum, Billy Dee Williams. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, it just never stopped. I was constantly going, is that who I think it is? Yeah. Is that who it is? And half the time it was, and half the time it wasn't.
You really couldn't have asked for a better ensemble voice cast. It just worked all together. It's a gorgeous movie, too. Although it is done with computer animations, they give the characters a sort of stop-motion animation to make it feel Lego-y. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to describe that. And some of the other animations were incredible. Like, there's a scene where they're on like water, and they actually simulated ocean waves with different colors, and it looked stop motion. It was mind blowing to see. It really was. And plus that song,
Everything is awesome.
This song that's done by Tegan and Sarah, and then even the guys from Lonely Island are on it. It's the new Let It Go.
It's
from
so
Frozen.
Crack friendly.
The new Let It Go. Let It Go ain't old yet.
That's it. It might be. This one stuck in my head just as much as Let It Go. It's really good. But as far as the final verdict, this is one of those rare instances where I go into a film expecting greatness, and it was actually pleasantly surprised. Although the pacing made me feel like I was on a two-hour sugar rush, it's hard to fault the movie considering its targeted audience. Mm-hmm. If $10 were a full price of admission, I would pay $8.50.
Is it as good as Wreck-It Ralph?
Well, you're talking to a video game enthusiast, so I liked Wreck-It Ralph more, but not just because of the video game thing. I think there was more clever things going on in this one, but it's close. I think this one has a slight bit more heart than Wreck-It Ralph did.
Oh, it's got a huge heart. And yeah. I saw it, and I didn't chime in much in it because I've already got so many other reviews to talk to, and I don't want to bore our audience. I thought it was infectious, clever, fast. It was really quick, and it's the most fun I've had in a movie, animated movie, since Up. That's how much I liked it. I loved it. Everything is awesome. It just $8.50 is what I gave it.
And so. I know I this is like in my wheelhouse. You guys mentioned that on the last show or whatever. Mm-hmm. Don't let that sway you from giving this movie a shot. It really is something to be seen.
Hey, I have a cold, dead heart, and I loved it. I left singing that stupid song, and I was having so much fun. And I went and saw it with my friend Tyler. And we were the only guys together in the whole theater. There's like 1,000 kids. We look like the biggest pedophiles you've ever seen. And we just sat there, and we sat in like those two seats that are together, like the handicap seats. And he's just like, why don't we sit in the aisle? I'm like, dude, I would rather look like the gay couple than the pedophiles. Just sitting there like, hey, kid, you ever smell chloroform?
You know. And Justin, if you do go to the theater to check this one out, wait a few weeks, because I remember sitting in the theater surrounded by hundreds of kids and going, this is what hell will be like for Justin.
Oh, God, that sounds terrible.
I enjoyed it. The kid next to me, it had no idea who I was, and he's quoting stuff from the movie and looking over at me saying, that was funny, wasn't it? It was fun. I had no idea
who you were.
Yeah.
Oh, Fagal.
All right. So I'm on Hollywood Outsider.
You should have, bitch. And I saw The Monuments Men. That's the one George Clooney directs and stars in. It's Frank Stokes. He's a leader of a platoon in World War II. He's tasked with that secret mission of retrieving thousands of priceless works of art that Hitler stole before he can destroy it. It's a really novel concept. I really like the spin on it. But along for the ride's Matt Damon, Bill Murray, John Goodman, Jean Dujardin, however you say it, and my pick for the best actress working today, Kate Blanchett. At the beginning of the year, I said this is one of my three most anticipated movies of the year, and I have to admit, I was a bit let down at first. The movie's not nearly as dramatic or serious in tone as I thought it would be, and that's not saying that the movie's bad, it's just, it's not the kind of movie I went in thinking it was going to be. It was a lot lighter than I thought it was going to be, but once I realized that Clooney was going for more of the Kelly's Heroes tone than Saving Private Ryan, I was actually able to adjust my expectations a little bit, and I found the movie pretty entertaining. It just wasn't as good as it could have been. But all the actors are in top form. Blanchett and Murray are the standouts as they deliver really the heart of the movie. My only other complaint outside of what my personal expectations were, it's the last third of the movie. That final act of this movie just feels a little bit tacked on. It's meandering. It feels like it doesn't know where it wants to go. And that's something that really took away from where I was about the midpoint. The midpoint, I loved the movie. You know, I'd readjusted. I'm like, oh, all right, it's a little lighter. I get it. But this is fun. This is great. And then the last act, I'm like, what? We're just going to go that route and be that quick? That part really bothered me. But it was still very entertaining. It was just a little different than I expected. If $10 is the full price of admission, this one's worth $7.
Still a good score.
No, it was. Yeah, it was still entertaining. It just wasn't what I thought it was going to be. Brian, let's talk about The Projectionist.
The Projectionist here follows a guy named Jacob Nix. He's a troubled war vet who's having a hard time assimilating back into civilian life. He's got basically some undiagnosed PTSD. It's pretty much giving him insomnia. So he's taking a job as a projectionist in this rundown, kind of a decrepit theater. And we just kind of follow his descent into darkness, which is pretty much fueled by addiction, seduction, and violence. Aaron, what did you think of this neo-noir?
Well, I don't even want to spend a little bit more time on the actual Kickstarter campaign and talking about that than the review, but I really love the visual style of it. Ryan Kennedy directed it. He did a really, really clever job, I thought, with the narrative, which are the bookends are in color, and the main story is told in black and white. It feels very noir. It feels kind of like a Jacob's Ladder mixed with a little bit of Taxi Driver, a little bit of Fight Club. There's a lot of different things that are thrown in here, and I really liked how they did it. The elements of PTSD coupled with Nix's increasing unstableness, his isolation, I just thought it was really harrowing how they handled the movie. And the score, especially, was something that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up a little bit later, but I mean, sincere, I mean, you know, because it's not really a special effects heavy type of movie. It's the score was just phenomenal. I mean, it was kind of the eerie tones and everything with it was, I thought personally, was kind of on par with some of the kind of upper echelon of like horror movies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's just really, really eerie.
And it was used more for effect than just to carry the scene. You know what I mean? I mean, it was the song, the music played a huge part in telling the story.
Yeah, no, I agree. It wasn't so much like it felt like it was, oh, hey, there's some ominous music. Something bad's about to happen. It was like another character in the movie. It was just part of the scene, and it just kind of really maybe drove home some of the emotions that was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. Most of these people you probably haven't, you know, heard of, or maybe, but you, there's a lot of people in here. I think you probably like recognize their faces. Ryan Russo was the lead guy. He played Jacob Nix in this. I thought he was really strong as this, you know, as the troubled, you know, veteran. And this Natasha Alam, forgive my mispronunciation.
Yeah, she was really good.
She was. I mean, just a cold-hearted bitch of a hooker. Just, you know, did anybody else stand out to you? Or did maybe just those people?
I like Dougie Doug's take as like the homeless drug dealer. I kind of thought...
The Cool Runnings guy?
Yeah, the Cool Runnings guy, man. And he does like a dramatic turn. You know, there's some humor sprinkled in there, but... It's more of a dramatic turn. It's really he gives a good performance.
Huh.
I was like, kind of surprised that he would do a dramatic role, but he did a good part. But you're right, Nix is really the heart of the movie, and everything that happens to him is really what we're following. He just gave a harrowing portrait. He doesn't have a whole lot of dialogue. You know, a lot of it is just looks and his, you know, obsession with movies and seeing, you know, which is probably why I could relate. But this is gonna be me in a few years. But the way that he portrayed it, and he tried to convey exactly what was going on in his head with just his face and his physical appearance and how he handled his everyday movements. It just, he did a good job with it. I was actually impressed with him, and I did not know who the guy was.
I kind of, let's go ahead and jump here to the score here. What kind of a score did you give it?
It's a completely different kind of movie than Monuments Men, but I liked it just the same. I gave it $7 out of 10.
All right. Well, we pretty much agreed with that. I initially kind of gave it about a 6.5, but I rounded it up to a 7 here for a number of reasons. I actually went back and I watched a little bit more of it again and kind of grew a little bit more of an appreciation for it. So I upgraded it to a 7. So,
well, I'm sure they'll be very, very happy about that. Now,
I'm sure the crowds are going wild at this point.
All right, Brian, now we've talked about the movie. Now, talk a little bit about what the Kickstarter campaign is, because it's different from other Kickstarter campaigns we've heard about in the past, which we normally stay away from.
I guess the general plan is, hey, we want to make this movie. We've got it to a certain point, but we need money to start this movie. This is different. This movie is already made. It's already a feature-length movie. It's done. It's in the can. It's done. It was made by donations from friends and family, etc. The hard part is over. Now what your donations and pledges will go towards is getting it into a limited release in the New York and Los Angeles markets. Mm-hmm. Hopefully more than that. Of course, the more money, the more places it gets shown. Later this year, the goal is to have it available worldwide, you know, on places like Amazon, Netflix, iTunes. The goal is only like $10,000. We're not talking 2 or 3 million. I think they're up to a little over 7,000 as we speak. I highly recommend you go check this movie out. Go to Kickstarter.com. It's called The Projectionist, and I personally plan on backing this movie myself. So
really,
the movie alone, I think is good. You know, I think it's a really good movie, and I like to see. You know, it's I actually kind of like the aspect of just kind of seeing what I'm backing, and I believe in it enough, and I also like. It's actually got a message in there, you know, and it is shining as dark as this movie is. It actually shines light on a really important subject. So definitely plan on forking out a little bit of my own money to help us out.
Actually, the same here. And you can find the link. It'll be in the show notes. Go to the website. You know, if you find episode 129, it'll be on the show notes as well. Yeah, I definitely want to recommend. I think this is a really creative way to do it, you know, because it. People do Kickstarters for everything anymore, and I'm not giving my money for anything. I'm really not. You know, if it's not something I'm wholeheartedly behind, I'm not doing it. This is
Veronica Mars.
Hey, I was wholeheartedly behind Veronica Mars.
That's right.
This one I am too, because you know I've seen the movie, and obviously we've only seen it because we're reviewing it. But you know, the fact that a movie is completed, and you're not asking me to make your dreams come true, you're asking me, all right, we found a way to make our dream come true. Help us get it out there. You know, and I respect that. It's a different way to do it. I think it's an interesting way to do it, and I really hope it works for them. I really do. So, and you guys should look for that. Even if it just goes to video or however they end up, you know, moving it, definitely check The Projectionist out. It's a good movie.
Now let's go. I had some chips to eat.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
I'll simulate.
Let's go to the box office. Lego Movie built about $69 million worth of blocks. That's a lot of cash, man. That movie is huge. They were forecasting $20 million.
Wow.
That blew expectations away that much.
Whoa.
Because everything
did you not put the new
awesome.
Box office on this page? Cause...
Sure didn't. Mm-mm. Nope. Sure didn't. Keeping you on your toes, brother. The Monuments Men, well, they stole about $22 million. And that's not too bad. But, you know, when you got beat by a Lego movie, I don't know if that makes George Clooney feel good or not. Right Along keeps on trucking at $9.5 million. It's got $105 million. Like I said, sequel. Frozen refuses to thaw. It's still in the top five. $6.8 million. For a total of...
Man, let it go.
$368 million total, man. It's just wrapped up. And Lone Survivor won't die. $5.5 million for $112 million total. Huge hit. Now, we talked about this at the beginning, but Vampire Academy... opened in 2,676 theaters, it made $3.9 million. That
damn.
Sucks.
Just that bitch got sucked. Staked.
She did.
All right, folks, we have a light week this time. Only two films to talk about. First one up, McG, the genius. Brings us his next offering, 3 Days to Kill. This one stars Kevin Costner and Amber Heard. Those are really the only two names we need to talk about. A dying Secret Service agent trying to reconnect with his estranged daughter is offered an experimental drug that could save his life in exchange for one last assignment.
Mm.
Now, Brian, I know that once upon a time during your reckless youth, you actually had to start taking one of these experimental drugs after you got shot in the face a bunch of times.
Yeah.
You ready to get shot in the face one more time?
I will be shot in the face by Kevin Costner any day. So, yes.
Wow. Okay, then.
Hey, it's the love episode, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's love. Yeah. That's okay. A special, special, special kind of love.
Justin, you said Kevin Costner and Amber Heard were the only ones to take note of, but isn't Haley
Steinfeld?
Yeah, Steinfeld.
Yeah, the True Grit girl. Yeah. She's in it. She's special.
Who the fuck cares? What? I'm talking Amber Heard.
She looks really
probably
good.
One of the most lovely women on the planet.
Whoa, planet? I think you're stretching that.
Planet.
One. Yeah, you're stretching that.
She is so gorgeous.
She's not on the planet now. She may be like in wherever. County she might be in currently, but
hey, don't let Johnny Depp stink turn you off from her. She is a genuine knockout, and she's a damn good actress. But all right, fine, you want to add in the True Grit girl, fine. Her and Connie Nielsen both are in it. That make you happy?
Connie Nielsen's in it. Now I'm sold. I'm going to buy a ticket right now.
Boom. Whatever I got to do to get your ass in the seat.
Yeah.
I think it looks really good, though.
It looks good, but it looks like a rehash of like whatever that John Travolta, Luc Besson movie was. It looks like Taken. It looks like they just keep recycling the same plot. Old guy kicks a lot of ass and, you know, blows stuff up.
Yeah, but he sells it still, man. I mean, he's
I love Kevin Costner.
And he's funny in the trailer.
Yeah, well, Kevin Costner is an incredibly good actor, and it's kind of surprising just how long he stayed out of the limelight for a while. I mean, it really wasn't until, you know, he played Pa Kent that it seemed like I'd heard Kevin Costner's name, and now he's got quite a few things coming up. You know, unfortunately, Shadow Recruit's not helping him much, but he's a good actor, and I'm really glad to see him come back because, yeah, I'm sorry, he can kick the crap out of Liam Neeson acting wise any day. Next up, some people have called this Titanic on a volcano, and I think that's somewhat appropriate. Take those two ideas, mash them together, stir in some Paul W.S. Anderson to direct it, and then put in a little Jon Snow action. I'm sorry, I meant Kit Harington into the mix, and you've got a slave turned gladiator finds himself in a race against time to save his true love, who's been betrothed to a corrupt Roman senator. As Mount Vesuvius erupts, he must fight to save his beloved as Pompeii crumbles around him. Aaron, this has got so much going for it, and yet something's really not going for it. Is this a volcano you're willing to jump into?
Fuck no. This looks like, it looks like poo, really.
It should be called Pompoo.
It looks like poo. Looks like, I don't think you could have put it any more kindly and gently.
Pompoo. That's right. Pompoo.
I hate to laugh at your jokes, but that was good.
It's actually, that was Scott's joke. I just stole it.
Oh, good.
It's
good.
Just,
well, now it's not funny, right, Justin?
Exactly.
No, it's actually still funny.
Actually.
I could just picture Jon Snow at the top of the volcano doing the Jack from Titanic pose, you know, with his arms outstretched going, hold me, Rose. That's what I picture with this kind of, yeah, it just looks, I like the concept. I like the actors. It's just not, yeah, no.
I'm not as excited for it as I was when they first announced it with that teaser trailer several months ago.
It looks beautiful. Looks beautiful.
Yeah. I love disaster movies, you know, and you throw Jon Snow into it, I'm in, but the more I see it, the more I'm like,
I'll go watch the Tommy Lee Jones version of called Volcano.
All right, let me throw another name at you. Kiefer Sutherland.
All right, so I'm going to go see the movie now, and right. I'll let you guys know how it is.
But Kiefer Sutherland is in it?
Yeah.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he is in it.
That so just sounds like a bad miscasting.
Yeah.
It sounds like slumming is what it is. He's like, man, I got to work. Jack Bauer got to eat.
Jack Bauer versus Jon Snow.
Jack Bauer wins.
Snow versus lava. Does anyone here want to see this movie?
Snow versus lava. Why didn't you lead with that?
Because I just thought of it, because I'm dumb.
I do want to see it, but I don't know if I want to rush out to the theater to see it.
Yeah, I got to agree with Scott on that.
I'm kind of surprised, because it seems like if you're going to pay money, I mean, the special effects and everything, it seems right up
true.
Both of your alleys, honestly.
It's one of those things where there's three or four things that add up. You're thinking, yeah, this is, you know, this, it's got this and that, and it works. And, but it just doesn't seem like it's going to work.
Fair enough, man.
The one aspect of this that really gives me pause is the director, Paul W.S. Anderson. He has got some, I hate to use the word hits, but I'll use it. He's got some hits and he's got some, or more than some, misses. I mean, in his favor, he did direct Event Horizon, which is probably one of the best horror movies I've ever seen.
It's his only good movie, as far as I'm concerned.
I liked Resident Evil. I actually really liked Death Race.
Sorry.
But I gotta tell you, even now, I really, really want to see this. The trailers have not dissuaded me at all. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think once Vesuvius erupts and just shit is going down, it's going to be a hell of a ride. Now all I can do is hope that I'm not just just sorely disappointed.
You worried they're going to Pearl Harbor it?
I am. Oh, man. Yeah, I'm afraid this is just going to blow up in my face and just not do it.
There's going to be a lot of stoic looks into the camera, a lot of accents, and a lot of lava. That's the movie.
A whole lot of fire and not a lick of smoke to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm afraid of. But, guys, these are the two films we've got to pick between 3 Days to Kill and Pompeii, both opening February 21st. Of these two films, which one are you most desiring to go see in a theater? Aaron?
3 Days to Kill.
Scotty?
3 Days to Kill.
Brian?
I'm torn between my love of Sword and Sandals and special effects and my love for Kevin Costner, but my love for Kevin Costner is greater. So, 3 Days to Kill.
You just had to throw love in there again, didn't you?
Love
episode.
Love is in the air.
I got to give it to Kit Harington.
Yeah, you do.
His abs alone, you know. I don't have a guy crush yet on Game of Thrones, but man, you know, take all those Blackguard furs off of you, and I guess, you know, he's got a pretty good ab pack going on there. But no, it's the spectacle of Pompeii that really I've got to get into a big screen just to see that mountain blow up and all that. So I'm going to go with Pompeii. To me, that needs a theater.
All right there, Brokeback. Now, you can listen and subscribe on iTunes, your Stitcher Radio app. Give us a thumbs up if you do, or through our RSS feed at thehollywoodoutsider.com. There is a new episode every Thursday.
What's this movie?
What's this movie? Each week we play ours or a listener-suggested clip from a movie. And if you think you know what the clip is, email us at feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com, and next week we'll give you a proper whole shout-out. Last week's answer was my choice, and apparently you guys were right. It was too hard because like almost every answer was wrong. So, but we did have three that got it correct. It was Punch Drunk Love. I really thought more people would get that. But Sean McDonald, he got it right, and he actually said it's very apropos choice with the passing of Philip Seymour Hoffman. One of my favorite roles is the crook mattress guy in Punch Drunk Love. I really thought more people would get it. But also, Austin Price and Alfredo Reyes got it correct. Congratulations, guys, because you're in the minority. This week, it is Justin Stern. And if you think you know what this is, and you better know what this is as far as I'm concerned. Just because you listen to this podcast, you better know what this is. Email us at feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com, and we'll give you a shout-out next week. Here's your clip.
This is for you new people. I only have one rule. Everyone fights, no one quits. If you don't do your job, I'll shoot you. You get me?
We get you, sir!
Welcome to the Roughnecks.
Ratcats, Roughnecks!
Obviously, if you didn't know it, because we do have people on the show that didn't get it, I'm not going to fault you for it. I'm just giving you a hard time. Don't get sensitive. This is all about love this week. I love you.
I don't think that clip was about love, though.
No, it wasn't.
I think that was about killing.
It was about some dying. All right, and a quick mention, The Walking Dead, they just came back, they had their mid-season premiere, whatever you want to call it. It beat the frickin' Olympics. I'm just, lazy zombies always trump athleticism.
Oh, this Olympics is kind of sucking.
Well, apparently everybody's infected. I mean, they've got zombie eyes. Bob Costas can't even host anymore. I mean,
I know. He looked like he was something out of 28 Days Later.
Did you see the shot of him at the desk and it's all like
a pink
ice?
Eye?
Yeah.
And they're like, This is Bob Costas coming to you live from the Fortress of Solitude.
That was so good. Oh, boy. Well, next year's Fox show Gotham has been cast, and Ben McKenzie is taking the reins as Commissioner Gordon. We've talked a little bit about it, but now we kind of have a better idea of what the show is going to be, because we're also getting Alfred and the Penguin. Do you think the show is heading in the right direction, Brian?
I think it's I think it's pretty interesting direction here. I mean, everybody's really young. I mean, the guy that's playing the Penguin, the Penguin is not the leader of this organization at the time. He isn't an ambitious henchman, so to speak, right-hand guy, lower-level guy. I'm not exactly sure how far up the chain he is. But so it's going really far back. Alfred is apparently fresh out of the Marines. He's hard as nails type of guy. So it's got me curious. It's got me pretty interested in this, even though it is on Fox. It's a step above CW, which... Mm-hmm. Arrow aside, pretty much is junk.
Supernatural aside as well.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Thank you.
I swear you work for that show.
I'm wearing a Supernatural shirt right now, motherfucker.
Yeah, you probably got Supernatural panties on too, so it's all good.
I do. They say Dean on the front, Sam on the back.
So they going small, wow. The Smallville route with this? Is that...
Yeah, essentially. But it's the thing that concerns me with Fox is if you put it on the CW, I feel like it gets a whole season. You put it on Fox, if it's not a hit right away, right. You know, I worry that it's not going to get time to develop.
Well, is Gordon already a commissioner on this show, or is he just a detective?
I think he's just a detective on the show. I say Commissioner Gordon's people knew who he was.
Okay.
But it's his, you know, coming up. And you're going to have Alfred and also young Bruce Wayne, you know, suffering with the murder of his parents. And I just...
Crying a lot.
Yeah, crying a lot. Weepy kid. Probably going to get into a whole lot of mischief. He'll be like Carl on The Walking Dead. He'll always be running around shooting people.
I don't need you, Dad.
I don't need you, Dad. The Walking Dad. What I want to know is, do you guys think that this is the wrong way to do it? I mean, if you're going to do a Batman series this far back, is Commissioner Gordon, or I'm sorry, Gordon, the character you want to follow?
Sure, why not?
He's probably got the more action in his life than anybody else at this stage.
I was just going to say the same thing.
It just doesn't sound like it'd be a fun show to watch. It sounds like
Stop being a hater.
I'm not being a hater. I love Arrow.
Push the hater right away.
I'm like crack on that. I like that. I'm looking forward to The Flash next year.
Well, it can't be about Batman. I mean, right, it really can't be about Batman. That's what's interesting about this universe. Anything before that besides the death of his parents wasn't really interesting.
But Commissioner Gordon has no superpowers. He doesn't do anything except solve crimes. Yeah, but he seems like he does. Gordon just, you know, runs around and solves crimes. I mean, is it going to be a procedural? Is that what it's going to be? That kind of show?
Arrow doesn't have supernatural powers either.
But I don't...
So then shut your face.
I don't see Commissioner Gordon whipping out in the shadows with a hood over him.
And a bow.
And a bow.
Maybe it's a cool eye makeup.
Maybe he'll use a candelabra. I don't know.
Arrow.
Yeah. It's a really, really misunderstood eye makeup. Like, why are you throwing eye makeup on, dude? You could put a mask on. It's cool. We'll see what happens with that. Now, out on demand, there's a little movie called Odd Thomas. It also comes out on Blu-ray and DVD March 25th, but it's based on the Dean Koontz book series, which I don't know if any of you guys have read it. But Odd Thomas is about a paranormal investigator with a special gift. He can literally see dead people. A lot of them. And when he notices an increased supply of Bodox, which are basically their spirits that feed off pain and death, he notices these following a stranger that Odd refers to as Fungus Man. Odd teams up with Chief Porter and his girl Friday, Stormy, to find out what's going on and put all this down before an apocalypse hits a small California town. This is a movie I don't think anybody really even knew was made. It was one of those that just, it kind of fell by the wayside. There were some kind of legal issues, so it just never came to fruition. Haven't used that word in a while. For the longest time, and now it's finally emerging. And Anton Yelchin, thank you. He was in the Fright Night remake, and he's also in Star Trek. This kid is perfect casting. Now, I didn't read the book, so I can't compare it to the book. But I can tell you that what the movie's presenting is Odd needs to be both clever, he needs to be funny, he needs to also be able to confront terror at every turn without really backing down, and he just needs a certain levity, and I think Anton just nails it. He just does such a great job. The movie relies very heavily on his narration, which really becomes tedious in a lot of movies. And I have a real hard time with most movies that do heavy narration. Ferris Bueller aside, this one really, you get a grasp of the character, and it also does a great job of telling the story. Like, instead of spending 45 minutes explaining how Odd Thomas became the guy that he is, you find out in 5 minutes, and it's done well. You know, it's done well. So I understand clearly 5 minutes into the movie what's going on. His relationship. What's that?
I was about to say, it's too bad you haven't read the book, because I've read it, and my wife is a huge, huge fan of the Odd Thomas books. They're quite good.
Well, then you definitely got to check this out, because the guy who directed it is one of your favorites, which I'll get to in a second. But his relationship with Stormy, very sweet. It gives the movie its heart. Willem Dafoe is Chief Porter in this movie, and it's nice to see him loosen up and have fun, you know, because that's always pretty refreshing.
Willem?
Did I say William?
Dafoe!
You idiot.
Well, symbology.
The movie was directed by Van Helsing and Mummy director Stephen Sommers.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And it shows the mix of horror and comedy is something that rarely works. Hardly ever does horror and comedy work well in a movie. Usually directors get it wrong. Summers knows this genre, and he nails it. He, outside of a few suspect special effects, which obviously were because the budget was a little lower, this is just one of the most fun horror comedies I've seen in a long time. I was really surprised, and I would love to see a series made of this, even though it seems like it won't happen. I would love to see this continue. Odd Thomas is available, you know, now on demand, like I said. And if $10 is the full price of admission, this one's worth $7.50. And Justin, you saw Chris Carter's Amazon new show, The After. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, Amazon, as they did last time, they've got a series of pilots that they're putting out there, and they're asking people to watch them and vote for which one they like best. Of course, out of all of them, I had to pick a show called The After. It was created by Chris Carter. It's one of those shows that it seems to be happening during some kind of cataclysm, but they never really say. I mean, it's not Pompeii erupting, or it's not volcanoes or asteroids. There's something that's driving society into an apocalypse, but you don't really find out what that is in the pilot. And I have to say, I really like that. By the end of the pilot, you really have no more idea of what's going on than when you started it. Too many shows give stuff like that away early on, and this one didn't. I really enjoyed it. Ensemble cast, they all work well together. The story works really well. I would like to see this one get picked up because I am curious about what's going on. I hope Amazon picks it up for a full season.
Well, we'll find out soon. Let's go to DVD and Blu-rays. Scotty?
Well, I hope our listeners are happy with all the reviews that we finally got this week.
There you go.
We got four releases coming out on February 18th, but there's only really one big one, and that's the third season of Game of Thrones. I am very excited to get my hands on that. Hopefully I can find another $20 copy like I did for the last two seasons, but I don't know. I kind of doubt it. We do also have a movie called Battle of the Damned. I kind of wondered why I had never heard of this movie until I was prepping for the show, and then I saw why. It stars.
Is it another dance movie?
No, it stars Dolph.
The undead, just, you know, hip hop dancing.
That would be fantastic.
It's like Thriller, but a little.
But worse.
No, this one stars Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, yeah.
Dancing?
And I had to.
Oh, I remember. Yeah, I remember seeing trailers for this a little while ago.
And I don't normally do this, but I had to read you guys the synopsis that I found on this movie. And I'm not making this up. Following a deadly viral outbreak. Okay, so far so good. Mm-hmm. Private military soldier Max Gatling. Yes, his last name is Gatling.
I like it.
Leads a handful of survivors and a ragtag band of robots against an army of the infected.
Ooh.
A ragtag band of robots. Just want to make sure.
Hey, I'm sure they all look like people because there's no budget.
So that's pretty much.
Sounds kind of awesome.
Oh, my God. Justin.
Robots and zombies? Holy
shit. Oh, God. Go to the next one. That's even better. You can get this one on Blu-ray for $7, by the way. Blu-ray, what? $7 is the one you're about to talk about.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Blu-ray? It's called
by the same people who do.
I was wondering that. It's called
whatever the fuck those movies are.
It's called Apocalypse Pompeii, which on the surface looks like one of those cheap ripoffs that you see at Redbox. You know, when there's a big movie in the theater and they kind of do a ripoff. This looks like it really could be that, but it does star the guy who played Sala in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, that guy, the guy who played Sala.
Well, he was also Gimli in Lord of the Rings. So,
all right. John Rhys Davis?
John Rhys Davis.
Yeah, I'm sorry, John
Rhys
Davis.
Wow, you can't pronounce a name for shit.
Yeah, and he's only been around for 50 years, including your favorite movie.
Hey. Yeah.
All right, last one is Fists of Legend. This is a martial arts movie that about three old friends and rivals who get set to face off on a TV program billed as the greatest fight show on Earth. And no, I'm not making any of that up. That is what that movie's about.
But I wish you would have made more of that up.
All right, with that, we'll go to our flashback segment. This is where once every other week or so, one of us hosts brings to the table a little-known or obscure movie that we hope the rest of the hosts here will, as well as our listeners, will give a chance. This week is Justin's turn. Justin, what do you have?
I'm going to be real quick on this one. This movie is called In a World. It was written and directed by Lake Bell. She also stars in it along with Rob Corddry, Eva Longoria, and Ken Marino. Nick Offerman's even got a small part in it. It's a real simple story. She plays this underachieving voice coach who finds herself competing for a movie trailer voiceover job against her father, who's quite an arrogant asshole, and his protege. It's all about trailers and the voices that bring you the narration of those trailers. Of course, everyone makes the joke about In a World, and the film just goes right along with that. It does. The film as a film is average at best and not even average in some respects. But for me, what was really more interesting was just the idea itself. Why don't we get more female narration when it comes to trailers? I can't think of a single movie that has a woman doing that whole spiel. It's always a guy. And I've never really thought about it until this movie. And then I'm like, why is that? As kind of a message movie, I think it works better than just as a movie. I watched it on Amazon. I downloaded it or I rented it. $1 out of $10, I give it a 6. Lake Bell's cute, quirky. She did a good job writing and directing it. It's not a big film. It's not really all that important, but it does bring up an interesting topic, and she's got a hell of a voice.
Well, in the honor of Valentine's Day, in honor of VD, we're going to talk about the Big L. Some serious, some not so serious, but hopefully all of this is going to be entertaining. So we're going to put away our man card, and we're going to be honest. We're going to put it out there. We're going to let you know what we really feel. We're going to talk about our feelings, whatever those are, or my feeling. That's really all I got is the one. So first up. And this one is just for Scott and Justin. Brian and I don't even get to talk for this segment. We just have to listen to these bitches whine. We're guys. Some of us are sensitive. Others are not so much. I assume that means Brian and I are not that sensitive. So for the sensitive guys, Scott and Justin, right before you guys break into song and stare wistfully in the mirror at yourselves, I want to know right here, right now, what do you like about romantic films when they're done right?
My favorite romantic films usually involve relationships. I don't go for the teeny bopper love story. To me, that's not interesting. When you're a young person, you fall in and out of love at the drop of a hat. I mean, it takes almost nothing to make someone just, oh my God, I'm so in love with this person. You know, and any time I watch a story where someone young falls in love and it's the most important thing ever and nothing will ever be the same, it makes me want to gag. Because when you're that young, you have no idea really what love is. You barely know who you are, much less how you feel about someone else. So when it comes to those younger, like The Notebook, anything, if you're 25 or younger, I don't want to see your fucking romantic movie because you know shit. But for those films that tackle people who are, you know, 25, 30, 35 or older, and you see love through the eyes of someone who's lived, who knows themselves, who's lost, and putting themselves back out there again, whether it's Sleepless in Seattle or a slew of other movies, to me, that's what really works. I like seeing people who are damaged putting themselves back out there again and finding love, you know, against some harsh odds. I don't want to see teenagers falling in love. Ugh.
For me, the two things I've got is one that is movies that do not do something, and that is to follow the typical formula of a romantic movie. Guy meets girl, guy woos girl, guy and girl fall in love, guy screws up royally, girl gets mad, guy figures out a way for her to not be mad, credits.
Misunderstandings ensue.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to be, it's got some other weird twist in it, but that's the basic formula, and I like a movie that just strays as far away from that as possible and does something fresh. I also really appreciate movies that have that feel like they really could happen. These romantic comedies, they just feel like a play more than more than real life. Just people, actors just in there just kind of just following, reading the script. You almost can feel them reading it off screen sometimes. Something that makes it feel real, like you really buy that these people are really in love, that they're going through real life situations, not something quirky and silly, but something that seems real life. It kind of makes you appreciate what you've got in your own life as well at the same time.
And for me, one of the most successful films at giving you a romantic movie, yet it's like a wolf in sheep's clothing, is Jerry Maguire. From the outside looking in, it looks like a sports movie. You know, it's about a sports agent. It's about football and football players. Yet at the heart of it is this really, really, for me, powerful romantic film, you know, about these two people who are so different and yet these circumstances come together and then their lives just become wrapped up in each other. And the ending of that film, I don't care how many times I see it, when he realizes just what it is he has in her and her the same, his Tom Cruise's speech at the end of that movie kills me. I cry every time. It's a cynical world. And he just, oh, shit. I'm starting to get weepy just thinking about it.
All right. Well, now we're done with you sensitive bitches. Some of us are a little less inclined to want to venture out and see a romantic film. That's Brian and I. So let's answer the age-old question. Why do men like us loathe being drug-kicking, screaming? No, it's drug.
No, you pretty much have to drug us to get us in there.
Exactly.
Slip me a roofie.
All right. Why we got to be dragged into the theater to watch these waterworks, Brian?
I mean, it's simple. Why do we go to movies? To escape, to dream, and men and women dream differently. Men love heroic shit. We do. We like, you know, we that every, I don't care if it's a Western, if it's sci-fi, war, whatever. It's the same basic plot. A little meek nobody overcomes improbable odds to save a city, a world, a universe, whatever the case is. And we want to feel like if I walk out of this theater and the shit hits the fan, I can save this world, including my date.
Mm-hmm. Single-handedly.
So, you know, I mean, in romantic movies, you got the lovable chucklehead, you know, insert Hugh Grant or Tom Hanks, whoever. And, you know, he's basically fixed in an hour and a half by a woman. So he makes mistakes. She corrects him. He's sorry. Movie ends with him happy. They're good guys. And you know, they've probably learned some great lesson in everything. They've changed their ways, you know, whatever the you know, the hurdle is, but they're not heroic. So we don't really latch on to them. Mm-hmm. But that's, I don't know. Maybe I'm.
No, that's just it. I actually like the movies. Like Scott said, when they're original, I really can't stand them when they're formulaic like that, when it's the same concept and you get the monologue, the obligatory monologue. I really hate the monologue. As soon as they start doing that, very rarely does that ever work for me. I mean, I'm just sitting there going, really? Who would ever have this conversation? No matter how bad the relationship was. And if you just wrong this woman that horribly, what woman's going to stand there for 10 minutes and listen to it?
Yep.
They're going to smack you in the face, go away with your best friend, and never call you again. That's what's going to happen. My thing is, I actually like the movies, but I don't want to pay for them. I don't want to go to a theater and go through the expense of sitting through another movie that I know is going to be pretty much the same, unless I read some reviews that say this movie's different. Like About Time, I want to see that one. I wish I would have saw that in the theater. Just because it sounded like it was a different one. You know, I just don't want to see the same movie, you know, How to Lose a Guy in 45 Days, Part 2. You know, I just don't want to see that anymore. If I'm going to a theater and pay for something, I want to see something either that demands to be seen on the big screen because of the special effects or because of, you know, it's just something that you have to see on the big screen. And it's not going to just be the same old, same old. Now, I'm not saying that action movies aren't the same old, same old. I get that. But the spectacle plays better in a theater than a romantic movie plays better at home, to me, personally. That's my take on it. Now, this question has nothing to do with PCBS. So just for you as a film goer, and be as honest as you can be, do you guys think that in this day and age, it's still okay to call movies chick flicks? If they're about a couple or relationship, is it okay to say chick flicks?
It doesn't bother me but that kind of stuff really does. I think that women should be more bothered by the term chick being referred to as the male gender than the movies themselves being known as chick flicks. Like, I mean, it almost makes it sound, it's almost like a derogatory term. You say, you know, oh, look at those chicks over there or something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, it's very, I don't know, I feel very Happy Days or something, that kind of, that era.
It's a little old.
It's a very old word.
It's dated, so to speak.
I think it's just more that, because it rhymes. Chick flick rhymes. I don't know. I don't use the term very often. When I do, it's usually in the phrase chick flick, and it has nothing to do with gender for me. It just has to do with that for, kind of movie.
For you, that means romance movie.
Right. It just means romance movie. It doesn't mean girly movie. It just means romantic movie.
Yeah, I'm not a, you know, I don't like the term chick flick, but only because when people hear it, they think of a certain type of movie, and usually the type of movie they're thinking of is a, you know, an average piece of crap romantic movie that's just not really worth your time, but it's purely for some simple-minded demographic. The term though, chick flick, I don't think is all that bad. I mean, my wife uses it. She loves to read what she calls chick lit. Again, you get that kind of rhyming thing going. So, you know, as long as women call each other chicks and don't seem to mind it, then I'm certainly not going to mind it. I just wish the term didn't have such a bad stigma attached to it. There are good movies out there that would be considered chick flicks. They just get put under that crappy umbrella.
I mean, I kind of disagree with that a little bit. I think it, the term chick flick just kind of refers to something that's just basically more marketed to towards women. You know, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a cookie cutter teeny bopper love story with, you know, ugly teenage girl is transformed into beauty queen who finally wins the, you know, the apple of her eye later in the movie or something. I mean, I just kind of think you know, you're talking with your guys, whatever, like, hey, have you seen the preview for that? Yeah, it's a chick flick. The girl, you know, my wife wants to go see it, whatever the case is. I don't think it necessarily, I think it can cover a lot of, you know, a lot of it, you know, whether it's a rom-com, whether it's just maybe a more romantic movie.
I would say, though, that whenever I've heard a male say chick flick, more often than not, it's said in a derogatory.
There may be an eye roll in there.
They say it as a, ugh, you know, that chick flick. It's not meant to be something positive or even neutral. It's It's definitely a negative. When women say it now, you know, I don't get that. But I think guys, when they use it, it's definitely not a good thing.
I hate the term. Always have. I just think it's chauvinistic. And I realize it's not. I realize, You know, every guy I know says it. So, I mean, it's not like I don't understand where they're coming from. It's just something that you grew up with and you're used to it. But I've got a daughter, and she loves action flicks and romantic flicks. So I really don't appreciate, me personally, I don't use that because, my daughter's not, it's not just a chick flick. It's just a flick. It's just a movie, you know. So I just never understood the connotation. I always thought it was kind of chauvinistic. But that's probably just because I'm overprotective and I don't like people calling her a chick.
From a psychological perspective, though, when these kinds of movies are made, do you don't think they're made for a particular target audience in mind? Well, or do you think they're just making it for everybody?
No, absolutely. I mean, they're marketing toward a specific audience. I just think, like you said, I just think, you know, chick flick is derogatory or it's perceived as negative because it's, well, now I don't want to see it because it's a chick flick.
Ah, okay.
You know, and you know, it's just like kind of, and I hate to say, but sometimes you go, well, I don't want to see that. It's a black movie, you know, or I don't want to see that. That's a freaking uppity white movie. You know, it's a connotation.
how many movies have you avoided because they're an uppity white movie?
I'm sure that there's one or two. There's got to be.
With Titanic?
Yeah, no, I love Titanic. Shh, don't you get me started.
There's a lot of uppity whites on that one.
There sure are, and they all drown. All right, guys. Now, that is these. Well, they did.
Spoiler alert.
All right, let's pick some couples. Now, there's, you know, we've seen, I don't know how many of these pairings of people. Some of them work, some of them don't. So you can only pick one, but you can pick one couple from both film and TV, Justin. So if you have an honorable mention, you won't hear it in the podcast, I promise you, so don't even bother.
So, no honorable mentions.
No honorable mentions. Pick one, movie and TV. So you get to pick two just from each medium.
I got it. All right. Can you shut
With
up now?
You, we have to clarify, sir. We have to clarify. Who is your all-time favorite couple, Justin?
And repeat. One movie, one TV.
There you go.
All right. Well, here's my first of the movie choices. This should come as no surprise to anybody who listens to this show. It's Harry and Sally. When Harry Met Sally is one of my top three romantic comedies of all time. I love it. Those two kill me. When I was going through a very, you know, kind of bleak romantic period in my life, you know, I call it the 20s. That film got me through it. You know, I would watch it once or twice a month whenever I was feeling low. And by the end of it, I believed in love again. I knew it would come my way and I felt better. So when it comes to cinematic couples, Harry and Sally have to be my favorite. As far as television goes, I got to give it to Buffy and Spike. Buffy went through a lot of dudes.
Buffy and Spike, not Buffy and Angel, huh?
Fuck no. All Buffy right. and Spike. And I'll tell you why.
Just tell me succinctly.
Spike loved her even when he didn't have a soul. And then he went about earning his own soul. He didn't get it given back to him via some gypsy curse or something else. He went and he got it. And their relationship, of course, she's a vampire slayer. He's a vampire. It's the whole Romeo and Juliet kind of thing. They shouldn't love each other. And for a lot of the show, they don't. But towards the last few seasons, they come to see in each other things they didn't see before, didn't want to see. And for me, that kind of pairing where they actually change over the course of their relationship is something that I really enjoyed. Most romantic relationships on television don't change either side all that much. Spike, in my really for me, is one of the most character developed or developed characters on that show, and it's directly because of his relationship with Buffy.
Okay, Brian,
I would go with. I wanted to go with somebody else, but I have to go with pretty much the couple from the greatest movie ever made, and that's Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman.
Ooh.
In Casablanca.
Nice choice.
Just, they're obvious. I mean, he's never stopped loving her. He had a small little thing with her for a while until she found out her husband that she thought was dead was alive. And then, you know, she left him, you know, at the train station. He's always carried a flame for her. She randomly walks into his bar, you know, their little flame reignites and he's really torn with this decision about, you know, I love her now. Am I selfish and keep her to myself and she's pretty much doomed to die? Or do I, you know, love her and let her go? So, anyway, one of the greatest couples ever. As far as TV, George and Wheezy from the Jeffersons.
Nice. I like it.
I mean, how can you not? I mean, you know, he's just like this, you know, this rooster, you know, he struts around and he talks a big game and everything. And Wheezy just, you know, keeps him in check and she lets him, you know, she gives him a little bit of, you know, room on that leash to run, but you know, he gets a little out of line and she snatches him back in into place. So love the Jeffersons. Anyway, I love them too. I thought it was just a great dynamic and just a fantastic couple.
For movies, for me, Harry and Sally, and Justin already spoke to that, so I don't need to add to it. They've always felt like they were the most real couple of all of them.
And his soliloquy at the end, you have to admit, is good.
It is. It's one of the few monologues I can stand. TV, Maddie and David from Moonlighting. I mean, for me, there's really no choice there. There's nobody that even comes close to their chemistry. Even though they hate each other offset, I mean, it was like passion on TV until they screwed up the whole series. But still, their chemistry was perfect. I love them. Scotty?
For me, TV, Bill and Claire Huxtable from The Cosby Show.
Oh, nice. loving couple.
They really were. They just seemed like what everybody kind of wanted their mom and dad's relationship mm-hmm. to be like when they were growing up. And just every episode, they worked so well off each other. Those two actors, you never believed for a second that they weren't really together. For movies, Carl and Ellie from Up.
Oh, that's nice.
For 3 minutes that mm-hmm. you see the two of them together is the most touching love story. You just see like these snippets and it's just, oh, it gets you so.
You're going to make me cry.
For real.
Nice pick.
Don't make me cry.
Nice choice, Scott. Nice choice. Very sweet. So how about the all-time worst couple? What are the worst couples on film and TV?
Anakin Skywalker and Padme. There, I said it.
Good call.
Episode 2 had some of the most awkward, unbelievable moments I've ever seen in a movie that was supposed to be serious.
Horrible acting and relationship status. Yep. TV?
I actually don't have one for TV. Again, I
don't watch enough TV?
No.
Or you just love them all?
No, be perfectly honest, I didn't read the format correctly and didn't...
That's all right. We'll wait. Go ahead. No, just kidding. So Brian?
Dang it. I hate to say it, but that was who I had. I just cannot stand Hayden Christensen and Natalie Portman really... It's just emotionally vapid. I mean, she's pretty and she's a decent actress, but in as far as showing emotion and stuff, there was just no chemistry really at all with those two.
She's a good actress with a good director.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. Apparently, maybe that's we'll blame the director, what have you. But the fact that, I don't know, it was just they I just never bought them to in any movie that they were any of those three that they were together.
The two of them falling in love in episode 2 just was it felt gross. Mm-hmm. it's just
uncomfortable.
Yeah.
What about TV?
He's got sand up his ass.
And it gets everywhere.
Yeah,
I know. He's all whiny and emo and stuff. And just yeah. As far as TV goes, I've got to go with a newer show, and that's Ichabod Crane and his wife Katrina from Sleepy Hollow.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry. They, you know, his whole motivation is to try to get her out of purgatory, and all it is her yelling at him in dreams and stuff, and waking up, and there's no emotion there. There, you know, they did a little bit to set it up early in the season, but at this point, I probably would have done forgot about her.
I kind of get what you mean, Brian. I really do. So. Justin?
Fuck, make it a hat trick. Anakin and Padme. That
wow.
In order for Vader's creation to really work, you have to believe that Anakin loves her enough to do the things that he does. And Hayden Christensen is by far one of the worst actors I have ever seen. How he got cast in that role, I don't know whose payroll George was given bribes from, how it happened, but it's terrible. Mm-hmm. It never once works. As far as TV, I'm actually surprised Brian didn't pick this. Cersei and Jaime Lannister, they are a fucking awful couple, and they kill people.
Oh, you went with just awful people.
No, they're awful people, and they're an awful couple.
All right. They really are.
They pushed a child trying to his death.
Yeah, I mean, but there's a lot of kids out there that...
Their incest baby is sitting on the throne.
But, I mean, you don't think they have chemistry? Because they're brother and sister?
You know, I think that the actors, they have a little bit of chemistry with each other, but it's everything around their relationship, the things they've done to hide it and thwart others, their rise to power. They're terrible people and a terrible couple.
Got it. For film, for me, Seth Rogen and Katherine Heigl are knocked up.
Really?
Yeah, the movie's funny, but they have zero chemistry.
I kind of thought they were good.
No, I thought they were an awful couple. The whole time I'm watching it going, really? No.
Of course, that might have been me just projecting, going, I'm him.
Yeah.
I wish I had her.
I think that might be it. And for TV, don't kill me, Justin, but Jack and Kate on Lost. Awful. Awful. I love Sawyer and Kate. hated Jack and Kate. Not one moment felt real to me. Not one moment in their whole relationship.
I think early on.
Nope. Not one moment. I've watched that series all the way through twice, and I love Sawyer and Kate. They could get me every time. Mostly because I like
Sawyer and Juliet were better.
Sawyer and anybody. Sawyer's just cool. Jack is just so bland, and those two had no chemistry. It's almost like Kate is like, oh, I'm forced to like you, but man, I'd rather be with anybody else on the island.
No, see, I never got that. He's a good-looking guy. He's a surgeon.
Well, that's why it's my pick and not yours. So, well,
once again, you show your pick and sucks.
Now, who is your all-time favorite floozy Jezebel Lothario ho, if you will, from both TV and film? Brian?
From movies, I got to go with, I don't know, probably the queen, Sharon Stone.
Mm. Ooh. There you go.
The infamous
basic,
scene.
You know, Basic Instinct.
I like
she
it.
She was even pretty much a, I mean, not only Basic Instinct, but a Total Recall.
You remember she was floozy and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 90s, she was just a big old slut. Casino. So.
And TV?
Honestly, TV, I don't even have one. I really couldn't think of one okay. that really stood out to me. So I have to skip that one. I'll probably steal one of yours in a minute.
That's fine. For film, for me, Julia Roberts and My Best Friend's Wedding. Mm-hmm. I totally would have ran away with her instead of Cameron Diaz. I'm sorry. He made the wrong call. You married the wrong one. And she was, because she totally wanted to steal her man. That's a floozy. And TV, Charisma Carpenter's Cordelia in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Now, not Angel, because she changed her character there, but in Buffy, she was kind of seen early on as, you know, the temptress, the Jezebel. And she just evolved as a character. I just really loved her.
She was great, though, in Angel.
She was. Her character became a lot cooler and more interesting in Angel, but I loved her in Buffy.
Oh, season 3. Oh, goddamn, that's one of the best seasons of television ever.
Scotty?
I don't have one for TV, but for film, I took a different spin with and took the temptress route a little bit. I picked Elizabeth Hurley as the devil in Bedazzled.
Oh, God.
I've never been a huge fan of hers as far as like on the hot scale, but she looked really good in that movie.
Oh, God. Have you not seen Austin Powers?
Scott's like, I'll sign the contract.
I like that movie anyway, but just her whole like, seducing him into doing all this kind of stuff. It was, yeah, I'm there.
Justin?
You know, I went a little more literal with this, with the favorite ho. And my pick covers both television and movies.
Okay.
Inara.
Ooh.
From Firefly and Serenity. She actually plays a prostitute of sorts. Of course, they call it a companion, but, you know, and call a spade, she a ho. But she a great hoe.
She's a classy hoe. She's a
classy hoe, beautiful hoe, and she ain't cheap neither. But I liked actually having a pick that covered both.
Oh, well, aren't you special?
Beat you.
He's very proud of himself.
Yeah, he is.
I am. Patting myself on the back.
So what is the one romantic film that others rave about and you can't stand, Scotty?
Pretty Woman.
Oh, fucker.
Really?
Talk for us both, because that was my choice.
I don't know. I have this hard time with the whole feel sorry for the hooker movies. I'm sorry.
You have a hard time pitying the hooker?
I do.
She's
I'm sorry.
Hooker with a heart of gold.
Yeah.
That's
a heart
fine.
Of gold between her legs.
I don't know. I've never been a big fan of that one, and that's like everybody's go-to.
I just love when he gets in Jason Alexander's face about basically calling her a hooker. I'm like, what are you getting mad about? She's a hooker.
All right.
How do you get mad about that? How do you cast out your buddy because he's being a douche to a hooker?
Right.
Touché. Well, like Justin said, you spoke for him. What about you, Brian?
This is, I don't know, maybe moral reasons or something, which is not exactly my strongest suit, but... Bridges of Madison County.
Oh.
Now, this is a movie that's, you know, recognized as a wonderful love story, and it's just loved. I mean, Meryl Streep was awesome. Clint Eastwood was great, blah, 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 great. You know, I think he directed it also. Mm-hmm. It's just lovely. I think it won Oscars, if I'm not mistaken. But it's about a woman who has an affair, cheats on her husband. Mm-hmm. Husband and kids are out for about 3 or 4 days. It's not like the guy's an asshole. It's not like he's beating her or, you know, nothing like that.
She's just a hoe.
She's just a hoe. I mean, dude comes in with a camera. Hey, how you doing? You got some bridges around here? Yeah. You want to run out back and
do
you
it?
Know,
do it on one of them.
Plow some corn. Sure.
You want to have the sex?
And it's, you know, but her infidelity is romanticized because she's banging Clint Eastwood. You know, I mean, I don't want to hear any more shit about double standards.
Touche, sir. Touche. Mine's Groundhog Day. Yep. Yep. Not funny. Not sweet.
Oh my God.
Just dumb. Just fucking dumb.
Fuck.
High just five. Dumb. High five right here.
Internet high five. Just dumb. I just don't understand it. And basically, it's like you're making me suffer over and over and over. You can't even end the damn movie because I keep reliving the same shitty day.
Oh,
no.
I just want to keep doing the nuts.
Sorry.
I'm kind of...
That's so hard. Huh. It is so good.
No, it's not. It's really not. I'm heartbroken right now. All right, sissies. Fess up. There can only be one. What is your favorite movie love song? Brian, come on. You know you got one.
Oh, God.
Come on, sugar.
Okay, it's actually... I'll give you a clue.
Don't give me a clue. Just tell me the fucking song. We ain't got time for clues, son.
All for Love by Bryan Adams, Sting, and Rod Stewart from Three Musketeers.
Aw.
Huh.
Very nice. Not Everything I Do. You did the All for
Love.
I know.
Love. I was about to say Everything I Do.
That was like 1A.
All right.
Or 1B. 1B, actually.
No, but that's a good song.
I don't know. It's sweet. It's loving. And the way that they all kind of rotate the lead in that, you know, in... Just it, I like it.
Fair enough, Scotty.
Mine is from a movie that I've been raving about a lot lately, which is About Time. And there's a song by the artist is Ben Folds. He's kind of a piano player, very popular. He's on The Voice now. Mm-hmm. The song is called The Luckiest. It's a super touching. It's just him and the piano, and I've got a personal attachment to that song because I've liked the song well before I saw the movie. It was actually my wedding video, so I had some of that going on when I saw this movie. It works so well in this movie that it was hard to I was fighting in the theater fighting it back. It just works. So
Justin, who swears he has the best movie love song, by the way.
Of course I do. Falling Slowly from Once.
Oh, that's a really good one.
The scene in the movie where they play this song is so touching because it's just two people trying to connect. They're in a music store. He sits at a piano and he gets a guitar and starts playing just a song that he's kind of been thinking of. The next thing you know, she sits on a piano. She starts playing it with him. He's singing. He's got that fantastic voice and the two of them just play it. And I can't hear that song without just getting a little choked up about the love that it talks about and falling slowly together. It is, for me, probably the best real true love song that I've ever heard in a movie. And it helps that those two actually had a relationship together and that it's not just a song made for marketing purposes, but it's actually a song those two wrote. So there's that added little bit of emotion and history to it. It's fantastic.
Good call.
Mine is from City of Angels. And
Iris.
Iris the Goo Goo Dolls. Well, hey, can you shut up? That. It's my pick. Shh. Stop talking. It's Iris from the Goo Goo Dolls, as Justin just told you before I even got a chance to. It's like it was stolen from me. But yeah, I
love that song.
It has a lot of personal meaning, which I'm not going to go to on the internet. But that, as well as I can hear that song. And I actually debated this one quite a bit earlier. And it's a song, if I put it in, I will weep. I won't admit it, but I will weep.
I had it on my list, and it was going to be my pick. And then as I was going through my collection of music, I just saw Falling Slowly, and I was like, that's the one. But Iris is so good.
Yeah, it's better than what you picked. Last question.
Okay. It's a close second.
You're sitting at home. Your woman, or man, in Scott's case, just left you. You're a wreck. You're crying. You're in your tub with peanut butter, box of Kleenex, nothing but time. What is the go-to movie? What is your favorite romantic movie to remind you just how good love can be?
Brokeback Mountain. I'm just kidding.
Justin, it's your pick.
Oh, it's a valid pick. No, for me, it's Joe versus the Volcano. I mean, it starts off with Tom Hanks's character, just this abysmal loser, and it follows him through this sort of fairy tale story to finding true love. It's whimsical. It's so funny. Very, very touching. And it has some of the best quotable lines that any movie could have. Harry Met Sally is great, but Joe versus the Volcano, that's what I'm going to go to first.
All right, Brian?
I got to go with The Princess Bride.
Ooh, nice pick.
True love, you know, wins out. You got the perfect mix of comedy, a little bit of action. It wasn't even ruined by the poor movie sets, you know, backgrounds and stuff.
True love.
He clearly said to blathe.
To blathe.
Mine is Titanic. You know, Titanic is my.
God, I believe 12 hours of just misery, just feeling.
I love it. If I want to get all mopey and spend copious amounts of time thinking about the one that got away, Jack and Rose do it every time. Sorry, I have no shame in that. People are like,
well, he got away because she let him go.
That's true, because she killed him. What about you, Scott?
Well, I had Princess Bride on my list originally, and I changed it to one that I know that Brian hates, which is The Notebook. It's a go-to. I know it's an easy choice, but
it's like manufactured to make tears.
It really is. It's one of the I talked about movies that where the love story feels real, and those two just really make you kind of see the progression, and they go through ups and downs, and a real big down. There's very few movies that really can make me just sob uncontrollably by the end of it, and I have to even. Watching it multiple times now, I really have to fight back. It is so touching.
I do love the ending to it. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I thought you were going to say Drive. I'm like, that's a romantic movie.
Remember Gosling and Drive? All right.
His car, he loved it.
Now, let's hear some listener ones. There's some ones on here people didn't think about. Lisa Connard said, Sweet Home Alabama. Got little Reese Witherspoon. She's been lacking on this list.
You brought a baby.
What?
To a bar.
Ashley Stewart, most accurate representation of love on film was Brokeback Mountain. I felt the love.
Yes, yeah, so I would agree. So did Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yep. Repeat it.
Do we have to make jokes about the only gay movie mentioned?
Yeah, we do. And I just want to say, I agree with you from the emotional aspect, but how quickly they went into the relationship was absolutely ludicrous to me. It was just ludicrous because they just jumped into it. Now, after that, I really bought into it. They thankfully sold me on it. But that first night in the tent or whatever was way too quick. It was just for me, and just personally.
You like to be romanced a little bit more?
A little dinner and movie first.
Yeah, a little dinner before you rape me in the tent. Scott Calgaro or Garo?
No, I was pronouncing it wrong.
Okay.
So you Calgaro.
Idiot. Favorite overall performance is Some Kind of Wonderful. Beautiful story and the ending was epic. This is a convenient pick because I've always liked the couple of Eric Stoltz and Mary Stuart Masterson. Yes, it dates me as an 80s kid, but this has always been my favorite. Honorable mention to keep Justin happy when Harry met Sally.
Yay!
Yay. Stephen White, Love Actually. Can't believe nobody said that. Knocked
I've
Up.
I've never seen it still.
Oh, well, you got to watch it. It's a great movie. Knocked Up. Sorry if I destroyed that one for you. Sorry. Wedding Crashers, Wimbledon. The movie isn't that great, but we don't have enough tennis movies. That's what he said. When Harry Met Sally, Romancing the Stone. Great call. Worst on-screen couple, Sarah Jessica Parker and anyone.
Yeah. Amen.
These are great. Craig Schermerhorn, About Time and Where the Heart Is for rom-com. Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone from Crazy Stupid Love.
Wait, did he say Where the Heart Is?
Mm-hmm. That's what he said. Hey, it's his picks, man.
Okay.
Costner Sarandon from Bull Durham for on-screen chemistry. That's a good pick. That's a good choice. Jason Taylor, Four Weddings and a Funeral. Great movie. The Princess Bride, Romancing the Stone again. The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill but Came Down a Mountain. High Fidelity, and Groundhog Day. Guess what I disagree with. Best Screen Couple, Douglas Turner for Romancing the Stone. And Han Chewie from Star Wars. Worst Couple, Douglas and Turner from Jewel of the Nile. Okay, that's funny. Jacob Bahi or Ba? I think it's Bahi. I think it's Bahi. I don't know. But Forgetting Sarah Marshall, besides being funny, I really like how she turns the tables on him near the end. Agreed. The speech about how she tried to fix the relationship, it makes the movie more true to life, making her less of a villain and him less of a poor guy who was dumped for no reason, and also showed us his penis for no reason. Molly Williams, Just Like Heaven and How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. No, Molly, you can't have How to Lose a Guy. I'm sorry, we're going to retract that one. Just kidding.
Bullshit.
Sean McGuire, The Notebook is pretty good. Rom-com, I'd go with 50 First Dates. What about The Wedding Singer, Sean? What about The Wedding Singer? Come on.
Love Stinks.
Oh, God. Amy Salto North, The Proposal. Ryan, Sandra, and Betty. What could go wrong? Touche. I didn't love that movie, but a lot of people did. David McGrath. Does anybody remember Late for Dinner from 1991? I do. With Peter Berg, Brian Wimmer, and Marcia Gay Harden. It was a good movie. I remember that one. It's a great movie about two guys cryogenically frozen for 30 years to try to reconnect with loved ones. It's funny, romantic, and a great tearjerker ending. Unfortunately, I don't think it's available on DVD, so if you can find it. Brandy Lyon Stewart, absolutely love How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. You're so vain. So apparently I have to retract my retractable and make sure that one stands. Gene Morton, favorite Look Who's Talking and House Sitter. Worst screen couple, Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz in Night and Day. Good call.
I like that movie. Fuck that.
I like the movie, but I didn't like them as a couple. Paula Sell, He's Just Not That Into You, Safe Haven, For the Love of the Game, Pretty Woman, which is also the best screen couple, Richard and Julia. Yeah, you probably hated some conversation a few minutes ago. Sabrina Elkins, Toy Story 2, Potato Meets His Missus. Aw, that's nice. That's a nice pick. Marcus Shelton, I Can't Get Enough of Notting Hill. It's a movie I can watch every time it shows up. Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts are dynamite.
That was one of my first flashbacks.
Yeah, it was. And the side characters make the movie. Wow, that was a lot of response. People love, love. And with that, let's go to Ho Corner. Brian, you've got one quick thing, and then we'll wrap up, because I know we're always going long. So, go.
All right, real quick. You know, hey, love is obviously the big topic this week. So, we all love movies where people end up together in the end. But what is your favorite breakup movie? Aaron, start with you.
War of the Roses, hands down.
Ooh, yeah.
If you're going to break up with somebody, that's how you do it. Horribly
pissing their fish.
Pissing their fish. Yep.
What about you, Justin?
You know, I'm going to go. I was originally going to go with War of the Roses, but Aaron picked it, so I went with Chasing Amy. You know, this is a Kevin Smith movie from back in the day. A guy falls in love with a lesbian, kind of turns him around, and then fucks it up royally.
Yeah. Speaking of double standards, it kind of makes you question our perceptions on. Mm-hmm. On standards that we hold people to.
What about you, Scott?
Mine is High Fidelity. It's basically a movie about breakups, really. He's given his top five breakups throughout the whole movie. It's about a guy that you feel sorry for. He's talking to the camera, and he loves music. It's pretty much right up my alley.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I got to go with Swingers.
Good one.
It really
shows you what, you know, what a lot of times happens with breakups, and that's you generally speaking don't really get over it for quite a while.
Your money,
you know, it's
baby.
Not like, you know, it's not just once the credits, you know, hey, in an hour and a half, you're over it. It's, you know, I mean, it's about a guy that's months after his breakup, he's living cross country. He still is, you know, pining over this girl and tries to get out there and has some very awkward moments that unfortunately are a little too relatable, you know, with the like multiple phone calls and stuff like that and bumbling, looking like an idiot in a bar and stuff. So
his messages.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd have to say Swingers.
Wasn't he in a makeout session with the girl and he got up to like go make a phone call and try to call her something?
Yep.
And then he got Heather Graham.
And Facebook, anybody that likes us on Facebook, we'll mention you on the show, facebook.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. This week, Brandy Leon or Lyon Stewart, thanks for liking the Hollywood Outsider. And real quick, we got a couple emails. Justin?
First one's from Alfred Reyes. He says, the answer to what's this movie is Punch Drunk Love. Also, I totally find your show so entertaining. I can't wait till Thursday for a new episode. Well, here you go.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate that.
X's and
we've
O's.
Got a email from Scott Calgaro, or Garo, depending on how Scott wants me to say it this week. I have a recasting the classics challenge for you guys. I'm making this challenge because my wife and I are absolutely positive this movie can't be remade. Its success was directly attributable to the ensemble cast. I haven't heard all your episodes, still counting down episode 100. So if you've already done this one, shit can this email. I want you to recast The Princess Bride. Did we do that one?
We did.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, but, I thought we did, yeah.
Yep, we did. But I'm not going to shit can it because I appreciate you sending the email. But I don't know the episode, so I'm going to try and dig it up and find out which episode it was and let you know.
But we need to keep a list of those.
Yeah, you need to keep a list of those.
It's your show, bro.
Whatever.
You don't do enough.
And also, J-Rock, he wanted to let everybody know that he totally agrees with me about Netflix. So I'm just letting you know. He said, totally agree with you about what Netflix, eventually not putting new episodes all at once. Good television needs time. I'm not going to read the whole email, but good television needs time to be digested. And you need to wait eagerly for the next episode and chew over the story. Not be able to devour a whole season all at once.
Nope. I'll bet you $100 they'll never change it.
I'll bet you it changes. I'll bet you within the next year it does.
All right, bro. All right. You $100?
$1. I'll bet you $1.
Oh, you cheap ass.
No, I'm just poor. All right, guys. Well, you know, this has been the episode. I hope you're all loved out at this point. Make sure you go to thehollywoodoutsider.com or tweet us at @H_Outsider. Facebook.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. Leave us a message or text us at 818-814-6426 or email us at feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. Listen and subscribe on iTunes, your Stitcher Radio app, or through our RSS feed. And tell your friends. You know, grab the posting from the website, share it on Facebook and Twitter. We would really appreciate that because it helps get the word out so we can grow and whatever you do with growing. That's going to do it for this episode of The Hollywood Outsider. Thanks to Justin, Brian, and Scott for being here.
Holly. We love you.
Aw. Brian?
Not really.
Brian?
Yeah.
All right.
I love you too.
All right. Remember, the next time you go to a theater where everything is awesome, buy popcorn.
Everything is awesome. Everything is awesome. Everything is cool when you're part of the team.
Soon we'll be taking another run. Right,
sorry.
That works too. Whoa.
What's up? Chloe's calling.
Jack. Mr. Hastings won't let me go to the bathroom.
We're not doing what you said again.
Damn it!
I've rewatched seasons 1 and 2 of Game of Thrones, but I wanted to watch 3 before 4 gets started.
Gotcha.
I'm going to try to watch all 3 again.
Back to back to back?
Yeah.
Nice.
That's a lot of titty, man.
That's why I'm doing it.
All of it appropriate.
That is, of course it is. Of course it is.
Aaron sent me a text today, just randomly said balls deep, and said, I just wanted you to feel uncomfortable while you're working around kids.
Bringing the love. Bow, 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 bow. You gotta admit, just hearing that makes you want to make love.
I can't hear that song without thinking of Carlton from the Prince of Bel Air.
Oh shit! I shouldn't have clapped. Sorry. Got the dogs riled up. A little less painful,
please. Less cock talk this week.
What?
Just a
little
bit.
That's up to you, homie. I've never started.
This was Love Week.